Welcome to Conversations from the John W. Fisher Studio of Yellowstone Public Radio. I'm George Cole. When you hear about the mountain, the numbers are startling. Mount Everest has an elevation of 29,035 feet, or 8,850 meters. Compare that to Granite Peak in Montana's Beartooth Range, which stands at 12,799 feet, and that's the highest spot, literally, in Montana. Let's talk about Mount Everest. Overall, only 600-plus climbers from 20 countries have climbed to the summit of Everest. Climbers' ages have ranged from 19 to 60, and at least 100 people have died trying to climb Everest. Cause of death, avalanche, falls, the frigid temperatures, or the effects of thin air. If you're going, the nearest major airport is Kathmandu in Nepal. Best climbing months are April and May, and we'll check that reality in just a moment. And the mountain, or goddess mother of the snows, stands near Tibet and Nepal. Recently in Bozeman at Montana State University, Peter Hillary and Jamling Tenzing Norgay, the sons of the Everest pioneers, spoke on campus. As members of the National Geographic 50th Anniversary Everest Expedition team, Hillary and Norgay celebrated and commemorated the first ascent of Everest in 1853 by their fathers, Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. Both Peter Hillary and Jamling Tenzing Norgay are my guests today. Welcome, gentlemen. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hillary is from Auckland, New Zealand, and Mr. Norgay lives, when not traveling, in Darjeeling, which is in northern India. Jamling Norgay owns Tenzing Norgay Adventures, a private company, and is a living member of a dynasty of climbers. 11 other family members have ascended to the roof of the world. Peter Hillary is a member of the Himalayan Trust, an organization founded by his father to assist the people of the Mount Everest region. He's also a guide, a fixed-wing pilot, a writer, a speaker, and for both these guys, it goes on and on. First of all, I want to hear about the mountain, Mount Everest. It is so hard for me to imagine what it is like, especially when you're going to climb to the top. Mr. Hillary, let's start with you.
Well, in many ways, Mount Everest is a fearsome mountain. I mean, it's not only the highest mountain on Earth, but it is so high and so massive, it penetrates right into the jet stream. And I guess what a lot of people don't realize is that, in fact, there are relatively few days in the year when you can climb the mountain, when it's not being buffeted by jet stream winds of, you know, 380 miles an hour. So it's a pretty fearsome place. You've got to respect it when you go there.
Jamling Norgay, when you climb the mountain, when you think about climbing the mountain, what are we talking about? Is it something that cannot be predicted? Does it take 5 weeks, 14 days? How do you measure time when you're trying to conquer the top of the world?
Well, I think a mountain like Everest or most of the mountains, you cannot really conquer it. You know, you sneak up to it, and then you finally, it gives you the opportunity to stand on the summit for a, you know, few minutes, and then you have to get down immediately. And because it's such a terrain that's very hostile, and you have no idea what's going to happen any minute, so you have to be very careful. You never let your guard down, and especially on a mountain like Everest, it takes about 6 to 8 weeks to climb this mountain, and the whole process is to acclimatize. You know, you have to go up and down many times. Because if a person were to go from the base camp of Everest to Camp 1 and Camp 2 and Camp 3 straight away, without acclimatizing, that person would die in Camp 3 within a couple of hours. And does not matter how strong or how fit you are, you know, any human beings have to acclimatize.
So how do you stage a climb like this? Do you, you know, I've seen documentaries, I've seen movies, I don't know how real they are, but on the other hand, you stage, you set up tents, and you have a place where you acclimatize, but tell me more how you prepare.
Well, a climb of Everest, I think a lot of people think that if you had a graph of the ascent, that it's a continuous linear ascent and eventually you reach the summit. Well, that is entirely wrong. It looks more like a seismic graph for an earthquake. I mean, basically, there's all these peaks as it goes up to Camp 1 and then Camp 2. In fact, we went to Camp 1 10 times during the course of our expedition in 2002. You know, to the South Col, our last camp, twice. So, you know, you've got numerous ascents and descents up and down the mountain before you get that final opportunity, both because of the need to acclimatise and the one to set up the logistics for the climb.
And Jamling Norgay, you mentioned that you can stay at the summit for just a few moments. What are we talking about? 5 minutes? 10 minutes? Why so brief?
Well, I think it's about 30 minutes, you know, it's sort of the average time that people stay up there. Because, you know, you've been climbing for 12 hours nonstop. You know, from the last camp, you leave at midnight so you can get there by noon. And you stay up there, take your photos, and then you get down because after noon, you know, then you start to get the weather starts to get bad. And you are running out of oxygen, you're tired, you can get a hypoxia, you hallucinate. You know, all these things can happen. So to avoid these, you try to come down as soon as possible for your own safety.
What are the more serious problems that both of you, maybe individually or together, ran into in your climb of Everest? Were you at a point where, you know, your lack of oxygen, that you were having visions and fantasies? Tell me a little bit about your personal experiences.
Well, in fact, those sort of situations are not uncommon. People often hear voices. Hallucinate, and it's very common for being in a very hypoxic environment. But you know, I think one of the toughest things about climbing on a big mountain comes down to the simple old situation of the duration. The expeditions are so long. You're away from home for 2.5 to 3 months on average. And, you know, people are homesick and they start getting worn out. They start getting sick of the food, probably sick of the company. But, you know, and I think that's one of the great battles, to stay positive and enjoy the other members of your team, to really, you know, be positive in the situation you find yourself in.
Both of you are also writers, and I'm holding in my hands a quality paperback, Touching My Father's Soul, A Sherpa's Journey to the Top of Everest by Jamling Tenzing Norgay. And tell me, your father and Peter's father ascended together in 1953. Touching My Father's Soul, that's a very, to me, a spiritual phrase, obviously. What does this book mean to you? What does this book do for your experiences, not only with your father, but also climbing Mount Everest?
You know, I think one of the reasons, it took me many years before I actually decided to write this book. And, you know, there are hundreds of books written about Everest and mountains and climbing, and they're all written by Westerners or foreigners, you know. There's only one book written by a Sherpa about mountaineering, and that was my father. And this is the second book written by a Sherpa. And the whole idea behind writing this book was to give the people, you know, around all over the world, a different perspective of climbing, why we climb, why the Sherpas climb mountains, and what the mountain means to us, to give the people some more idea and knowledge, you know, to share some of our experiences about our culture and the people, you know, because you go to a lot of places, people have no idea who the Sherpas are. You say, I'm a Sherpa, they say, oh, you carry loads. You know, they have no idea that we are a group of ethnic people that live on these mountains for almost 500 years.
That indeed is something that, let's go into more detail on that. The Sherpa, an ethnic group that has their mountain life has been their reality, right?
Yes.
And so as a Sherpa, how did your father meet Sir Edmund Hillary?
Well, my father had been, you know, in the Himalayas many, many years. He had tried to climb Everest 6 times before. And he was, his name was quite well known in the climbing community. And when the British came in with John Hunt as the leader, and Peter's father was there as one of the climbers, and John Hunt, you know, felt just right that he had to have my father on this team. And he decided that my father and Peter's father would make a great team together to actually try to get to the top of this mountain. And they looked like the most positive, you know, group, the pair that would actually make it.
When they went to the top in 1953, the initial ascent, how long did it take them?
Well, I mean, you see, in those days it takes an incredibly long time because they literally had to walk out of Kathmandu. These days we fly 100 nautical miles east from Kathmandu in a small aircraft and land at a little airstrip at 9,000 feet called Lukla that my father built back in the 60s, which has literally opened the door to tourism in this remote part of Nepal. And of course, that just takes us an hour. In those days, they spent a couple of weeks actually getting there. So their expedition was well over 4 months. You know, it was a long, long time and very, very remote. And I think one of the things that really gives you an idea of just how remote they were is that when they climbed the mountain, of course, no one knew they'd done it except my father and Tenzing Norgay. And when they descended the mountain, they caught up with a fellow called George Lowe, who was my godfather, and they repelled and descended the great Lhotse face, and as they approached John Hunt, the leader of the expedition, and the rest of them, they're standing there and they're examining their body language, and their conclusion was, and they were sort of hamming it up a little bit as they descended towards them, that the body language did not look very jubilant. And then all of a sudden it was all thumbs up and people running, despite the rarefied air, running at each other and throwing their arms around one another, and they knew they'd made it.
I should mention that Touching My Father's Soul by Jamling Tenzing Norgay is published in the quality paperback version, Harper of San Francisco. And Peter Hillary of Auckland, New Zealand, has a new book, In the Ghost Country, and it is just out. You were just mentioning before we opened up the microphones that it will be on the shelves shortly. Maybe he is already there. What is this book about, Peter?
Well, it's a series of stories, including climbing on Mount Everest, climbing on K2, going to the North Pole with my father and Neil Armstrong. But it's all these stories are set against an expedition I was on traveling across the Antarctic Plateau to the South Pole. And I guess the way we've used to tell the story is very much because when you're skiing across Antarctica for 3 months on this flat white continent, you know, one of the vastest shields of ice on the planet, your world is totally sensory deprived, and often there's white spindrift sort of drifting over you, and you really can't see anything. And in this rather sensory deprived environment, your thoughts, and that's what keeps you going, your thoughts tend to be very vivid, and it just seemed like the perfect way to tell a lot of the stories of not only going to the South Pole, but climbing Everest and surviving K2.
In the Ghost Country by Peter Hillary. Who is the publisher, Peter?
Simon & Schuster.
And it's just out, is that correct?
It's just out.
Okay.
Yes.
My guests today, Peter Hillary and Jamling Tenzing Norgay, they literally are the sons of the Everest pioneers, and they, in 2002, commemorated the 1953 ascent by their fathers, Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. Both Peter and Jamling were in Bozeman recently for a lecture and a series of talks at Montana State University, and we'll get there in just a moment. But the question I want to ask now is that both you gentlemen, I'm going to guess, are not only very fit, that's not a guess, I was talking about the age, I'm going to say upper 40s, I'm 60, so I'm comparing to my reality. Would you?
He's a youngster, this one.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
He's
okay.
The old man.
Norgay, how old are you?
I'm 38.
38, yeah. And sorry. And Peter?
I'm enjoying my last year in the 40s.
Okay.
Well, no further comment.
You average my estimate. I'm close. The question, which to me is a very serious question, would you have led the life that you have lived individually and collectively together if it were not for your fathers? I mean, you know, what type of impact did your fathers have on your personal life and what you've done with your lives? Peter Hillary, we'll start with you.
Well, you know, I think it's very much like this. I mean, none of us are really that surprised when you hear that one of the sons or daughters of a farming family decides they want to be involved in farming or agriculture. None of us are that surprised when, you know, a medical family where a couple of doctors are the parents, that one of the children, or maybe more, wants to become a nurse or a doctor. And in many respects, I would suggest that this is the environment that Jamling and I were brought up in Darjeeling and in Auckland, New Zealand. You know, we were in households where famous mountaineers came visiting and told amazing stories. And, you know, very often would say to each of us in our separate countries, hey, young man, do you want to come out and do a bit of rock climbing or do something? Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think it rubbed off on me. And I mean, it's just, I've never really wanted to do anything else.
And Jamblyn Tenzing Norgay, what about you? Your father's impact on you and your life personally, as well as what you're doing now.
Well, he did have a tremendous impact, you know, on my life. And I always looked up to him as my greatest role model, you know, and I always wanted to become just like him. You know, like Peter said, you know, you brought up in a family, you know, of mountaineers. You go out, you know, every vacation is, you know, they're going not to the Caribbeans or the Bahamas, but they're going up in the mountains and just hiking, you know, with the family, which is really nice. And that sort of gets us more exposed to the outdoor life. And then, you know, I particularly in myself, you know, I appreciated the outdoors, and I just said, you know, this is what I want to do.
Have either of you done anything else? I mean, like,
well, just recently,
Peter, are you a secret CPA or something like this? Or
well, no, I'm not. But, you know, it's true. It's the environment we really like to be in. In fact, just recently, at the end of last year, we had a fundraiser for sort of schools and hospitals and charities in Nepal, and it was in Bermuda. In fact, I convinced Brent Bishop from here in Bozeman to come to Bermuda and assist us with this fundraiser, which he did. And look, I don't think Brent will mind me saying this, but he really did look like a fish out of water. It's not his favorite environment, you know. I mean, Bermuda's a nice place, but I think this is where he likes to be.
Okay, now you are going to be on a campus, Montana State University in Bozeman. You're going to be talking to students, faculty, as well as people in the community. You are in rock country. This is a physically fit little community we live in Bozeman, but there are also people like me that do some exercise from time to time. But on the other hand, you know, we have the rest of our life that we're also dealing with. And I know both of you, and Peter, I'm looking at part of your resume here. There's a phrase, turning dreams into reality and setting new goals and leadership. And I suspect that you're talking to people that don't necessarily have to climb mountain peaks to get your message.
Well, absolutely. You know, I think all of those sorts of ideas and attributes apply to each and every one of us, and it certainly doesn't have to be climbing a mountain. I think the important thing for every person is that they do constantly set themselves new challenges, that they feel passionate about what they do. And quite frankly, I don't think it matters whether it's, you know, whether your love is hybridizing roses or writing unusual poetry or climbing Himalayan mountains or developing a new software. I think it's important that you do it and that you like doing it.
Mr. Norgay, how about you?
Well, I believe very much that you know, you need to enjoy what you're doing, because if you're not, then you shouldn't be there at all, no matter what it is. Don't do it because someone's asking you to do it. Don't do it because, you know, it's an ego. You know, do it because it's a passion. You know, you need to have the drive and the desire. And I think that's the only way you can accomplish something and you really enjoy doing it.
You know, as I read about both of you gentlemen, one of the things that struck me, Peter Hillary, is surviving the storm on K2 in 1995. Eight climbers were headed for the summit, and as it says here, 1,200 feet away from the summit, you decided that you were not going to proceed further. And the rest of it, the storm arrived, tremendous devastation. Seven of your colleagues died, including British climber Alison Hargreaves. What was that like? That must have been something that hopefully you have not experienced since.
But it was one of those events that happens from time to time in different people's lives, and often at the time, and I was certainly in this situation, you don't quite know what the outcome is going to be. And I even remember thinking, as I sat in this little ledge at the bottom of the bottleneck, just beneath the summit of K2 at 26,700 feet, that I wasn't altogether sure that this rather intuitive feeling that this didn't feel right and that going on wasn't the right thing to do under the conditions and the time of day. But I somewhat egotistically felt, you know, what if the others get up, you know, to the summit of the mountain and I miss out, and they come down with their summit photographs and go, well, why didn't you come with us? And this did occur to me. But then I thought, I've got to stick to my guns. I don't feel this is the right thing to do. So I did turn around, and I obviously, in hindsight, I'm glad I did, because my survival was absolutely in the balance all the way down, and it was a terrifying solo descent of the mountain that I hope I never have to experience again.
So how do you judge both of you as climbers, as adventurers, when you have to realize there are limits? When do you say, this is not going to work today?
You know, I think a big part of it is gaining your experience. And one of the other issues that people often ask is, you know, in relation to Mount Everest, is to do with experience, because there are a lot of stories, and they are true, about people with very limited experience going to climb Mount Everest. And, you know, I think it's critical that you do your apprenticeship. You know, you do your 10 years of climbing in the mountains around this beautiful state, and then, you know, go to Yosemite, and then head up to Alaska, and go to the European Alps. Do your apprenticeship. Become a seasoned climber and alpinist before you start taking on the enormous mountains, where you're going to need that sort of backdrop of experience and skill.
Any comments about limits, Jamling Tenzing Norgay?
I think, you know, you just have to make the right decisions sometimes. It might be tough, just like the one Peter made on K2. It might be tough, but you just have to make the right decision. And it's the instinct, you know, you get that through experience. And that's what we experienced in 96 when I was climbing with the IMAX team, where 11 people died on Everest. And at that same point, we decided, our team decided we were going to come down and wait at the lower camp, because we saw all these people going up the mountain, and we just said, no, even if they go get to the summit, no problem, we'll wait for our turn and see what happens. And before we knew it, you know, 11 people died that day. And I still thank my teammates, and, you know, I still pray to, you know, thank God for helping us make that decision to come back down.
Where I want to go right now is pretty much to the business side of climbing Mount Everest, and I suppose the same would be true somewhat in major peaks around the world. But as I understand it now, that, you know, you just don't fly over there and start walking toward the mountain. You have to have a license to climb. And I understand somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 for a license for maybe an expedition party of 6 or 7 or 8 people. And my question is this. Is it, and this is a glib word, I don't mean it to be that way, is it a freeway for climbers now, or is it still a very rare, rare experience? I would assume it would be, but tell me about the business of Everest, and is there a point where it has reached its max, where you're going to say, we're actually harming this mountain?
Well, I think commercialization has taken a big turn in mountaineering, especially on Everest, because it's the highest and everybody wants to, you know, climb this mountain. And there are a lot of outfitters out there that commercial outfitters that take in clients who are willing to pay $50,000 to $65,000, $70,000. And I think the most important thing is you know it's fine to make money, you know, off of a mountain or anything, but I think the most important thing is that you make sure your clients have experience. You know, don't take anybody just off the office because they're offering you this money. And that has happened quite a lot in the past. And hope, you know, these commercial outfitters stop this and make sure that they are taking people that have experience, that have done the apprenticeship, you know, to get to that point.
Who is the person who makes that determination? Each individual guide, or?
No, the guide, the outfitter should make that decision whether, you know, if there are 5 people signed up for this expedition to climb Everest, their job is to make sure that these people have had experience before. If not, then they need to assure them, or they need to ask them to climb these other mountains, you know, and then slowly move up and, you know, get, when they're ready for Everest, they should be the one to say, okay, well, now you're ready, looking at their condition, you know, physical condition and how they do in the other mountains.
Peter Hillary, what about you? Do you kind of parallel those thoughts? And as you grow older, what are your next physical challenges?
Well, look, I totally agree with Jumling. I mean, people need to go through the process of gaining their experiences. The outfitters do need to be more selective like that. And I think unless they are, we're going to hear about through the media another terrible experience like the one that Jamling witnessed on Everest in 1996.
The IMAX.
And it would not
expedition.
Surprise me in the least if it's a great deal worse, because there are a lot of novices going up there, people who can't really, basically be responsible for their own actions when they're up there. They require people, the guides, the strong Sherpa climbers, to be there to enable them to achieve their challenge. And I guess really I feel that, it's a bit of a hollow achievement in some respects. I think, when you've really had to depend on someone else, being truly self-reliant, I think, is part of the magic of going up there. But look, addressing the number of people who go there these days and the few days that people are able to summit Mount Everest in a given year, and I mean, I look at our climb in 2002 when we were both up at Everest. Arriving at the top, there were probably between 30 and 40 people on the 25th of May in 2002. But it was a fantastic experience. I mean, everyone's so excited that, they're relieved they can turn around and go down again. But there is a wonderful positive energy.
Oh, sure.
And, it is.
Amazing.
It's still an amazing accomplishment. It's an exciting feeling.
We could fill 30 minutes easily with, for each of you gentlemen, expeditions, adventures that you have done and been very successful doing. But I want to go back, and we'll come to you, Mr. Norgay, in just a minute. But Peter Hillary, what is your next physical challenge, other than meeting the Delta Connections, getting in and out of Bozeman? But what is your next physical challenge? Where are you going with an expedition?
Well, it doesn't say much about me. If I can't make a connection in an airline terminal. But I do rather better on the track side or the mountain side. But I got here in the end.
I have got a
couple of plans. In fact, Jumling and I have just been talking about it since we've got together here in Montana. But I am very keen to go back to the Indian Himalayas and do a bit of a traverse through some of the alpine regions there between a place called Badrinath and across to the actual source of the Ganges River, and then descend the Ganges River ultimately using traditional boats. And I've done a couple of trips on the Ganges, and it's one of the most wonderfully culturally rich rivers there is in the world. It really is an amazing place to go. So we're looking at that for later next year, and then I can't resist going back to Antarctica, which is another one of my loves.
Jamling, Tenzing Norgay, what about you? What is the next expedition that you want to undertake?
Well, there's a lot I like to do. There's a lot more mountains I like to climb. But, there's restrictions from family, of promises I had made to family that I would not go back.
Right. I made some, too.
But you forgot that.
Are they concerned about your safety, or do they just want you near home?
Well, safety, most concern is safety. And because, when you go to climb a mountain, when you go to do any of these extreme adventure sports, chances of coming back is 50-50. You never know what's going to happen. But, like Peter said, I'm the two of us now, in the past couple of years, we've been working together and trying to do more adventure travel together to try to explore new places, something where just the two of us have got along to know each other and we get along really well. And we have the same interest, same desire, we just have the same passion that gets us together. And we've been on the road now, doing a lot of our talks together, the dual lecture series that we've been running around, and it's been really fun. And I'm looking forward to maybe doing some more adventure activities.
Give us a brief geography lesson. Darjeeling in northern India, how long does it take you to get to the base of where you're up for real business as far as Everest is concerned? I know they're in that part of the world I am a stranger to, unfortunately, but from your home in Darjeeling to get to Kathmandu and beyond, how long does it take?
Well, from Darjeeling, it's about 1 day to get to Kathmandu. You drive for 3-4 hours and then take a flight in Kathmandu. And then from Kathmandu, you take another flight to Lukla, and then you walk from there for about 10-12 days, and you're at base camp.
My guest today, interesting conversation, Peter Hillary and Jamling Tenzing Norgay. And they are indeed the Everest climbers, the sons of the Everest pioneers. They were recently here at Montana State University in Bozeman. And In 2002, Hillary and Norgay celebrated the first ascent of their fathers of Everest, and indeed the first ascent of Everest in 1953, which of course involved Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. And I do want to mention that they both are prolific writers. Touching My Father's Soul, A Sherpa's Journey to the Top of Everest, written by Jamling Tenzing Norgay, is published by Harper of San Francisco. And In the Ghost Country, written by Peter Hillary, just out. And again, Peter, the publisher?
Simon & Schuster.
Simon & Schuster. And good luck to both of you, gentlemen, whatever you do in your exciting lives. It's been a pleasure and an honor to meet both of you. And Peter Hillary and Jamling Tenzing Norgay, sons of the Everest pioneers and members of the National Geographic 50th Anniversary Everest Expedition Team, were part of a leadership conference recently here at Montana State University that collectively was sponsored both President and the Associated Students. And I do thank you for joining me today for the interview. Welcome again for your participation as listeners. We want to thank the listeners at Yellowstone Public Radio for being part of Conversations. This is George Cole from the John W. Fisher Studio of Yellowstone Public Radio, and we are appropriately located at the Bozeman Public Library.